A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. Continued. Cassette 5, Side 1.
Pay me no mind, said the hermit. I'll not venture to soothsay before I've seen this contraption of yours, or taken a look at this Don Taddeo, who begins to interest me, by the way. Wait until I have examined the entrails of the new era in better detail, if you expect advice from me.
Well, you won't see the lamp, because you never come to the abbey.
It's your abominable cooking I object to.
And you won't see Don Taddeo, because he comes from the other direction. If you wait to examine the entrails of an era until after it's born, it's too late to prophesy its birth.
Nonsense! Probing the womb of the future is bad for the child. I shall wait, and then I shall prophesy that it was born and that it wasn't what I'm looking for.
What a cheerful outlook. So what are you looking for?
Someone who shouted at me once.
Shouted?
Come forth!
What's rot?
To tell you the truth, I don't much expect him to come. But I was told to wait, and...
He shrugged.
I wait.
After a moment his twinkling eyes narrowed to slits, and he leaned forward with sudden eagerness.
Paolo, bring this Don Taddeo past the foot of the mesa.
The abbot recoiled in mock horror.
Accoster of pilgrims, molester of novices, I shall send you the poet Sirrah, and may he descend upon you and rest forever. Bring the Thon past your lair, what an outrage!
Benjamin shrugged again.
Very well, forget that I asked it. But let's hope that this Thon will be on our side, and not with the others this time.
Others, Benjamin?
Manasses, Cyrus, Nebuchadnezzar, Pharaoh, Caesar, Hannigan II, need I go on? Samuel warned us against them, then gave us one. When they have a few wise men shackled nearby to counsel them, they become more dangerous than ever. That's all the advice I'll give you.
Well, Benjamin, I've had enough of you now to last me another 5 years, so...
Insult me, rail at me, bait me.
Stop it. I'm leaving, old man. It's late.
So? And how is the ecclesiastical belly fixed for the ride?
My stomach. Don Paolo paused to explore, found himself more comfortable than at any time in recent weeks.
It's a mess, of course, he explained. How else would it be after listening to you?
And true, El Shaddai is merciful, but he is also just.
Godspeed, old man. After Brother Kornhoer reinvents the flying machine, I'll send up some novices to drop rocks on you.
They embraced affectionately. The old Jew led him to the edge of the mesa. Benjamin stood wrapped in a prayer shawl, its fine fabric contrasting oddly with the rough burlap of his loincloth, while the abbot climbed down to the trail and rode back toward the abbey. Don Paolo could still see him standing there at sundown, his spindly figure silhouetted against the twilight sky, as he bowed and munched a prayer over the desert.
Memento Domine, hominum famulorum tuorum,
the abbot whispered in response, adding,
and may he finally win the poet's eyeball at Mumbly Peg. Amen.
Chapter 17. I can tell you definitely there will be war, said the messenger from New Rome. All Laredo's forces are committed to the plains. Mad Bear has broken camp. There's a running cavalry battle, nomad style, all over the plains. But the state of Chihuahua is threatening Laredo from the south. So Hannigan is getting ready to send Texarkana forces to the Rio Grande to help defend the frontier, with the Laredans' full approval, of course.
King Garaldi is a doddering fool, said Don Paolo. Wasn't he warned against Hannigan's treachery?
The messenger smiled. The Vatican Diplomatic Service always respects state secrets if we happen to learn them. Lest we be accused of espionage, we are always careful about.
Was he warned?
The abbot demanded again. Of course. Garaldi said the papal legate was lying to him. He accused the church of fomenting dissension among the allies of the Holy Scourge, in an attempt to promote the Pope's temporal power. The idiot even told Hannigan about the legate's warning. Don Paolo winced and whistled.
So Hannigan did what?
The messenger hesitated. I suppose I can tell you. Monsignor Apollo is under arrest. Hannigan ordered his diplomatic files seized. There's talk in New Rome of placing the whole realm of Texarkana under interdict. Of course, Hannigan has already incurred ipso facto excommunication, but that doesn't seem to bother many Texarkanans. As you surely know, the population is about 80% cultist anyhow, and the Catholicism of the ruling class has always been a thin veneer.
So now, Marcus, the abbot murmured sadly, and what of Thantario?
I don't quite see how he expects to get across the plains without picking up a few musket ball holes just now. It seems clear why he hadn't wanted to make the trip, but I know nothing about his progress, Father Abbot. Dom Paolo's face was pained.
If our refusal to send the material to his university leads to his being killed...
Don't trouble your conscience about that, Father Abbot. Hannigan looks out for his own. I don't know how, but I'm sure the Thon will get here.
The world could ill afford to lose him, I hear. Well, but tell me, why were you sent to report Hannigan's plans to us? We're in the Empire of Denver, and I can't see how this region is affected.
Ah, but I've told you only the beginning. Hannigan hopes to unite the continent eventually. After Laredo's firmly leashed, he will have broken the encirclement that's kept him in check. Then the next move will be against Denver.
But wouldn't that involve supply lines across nomad country? It seems impossible.
It's extremely difficult, and that's what makes the next move certain. The plains form a natural geographical barrier. If they were depopulated, Hannigan might regard his western frontier as secure as it stands. But the nomads have made it necessary for all states adjoining the plains to tie up permanent military forces around the nomad territory for containment. The only way to subdue the plains is to control both fertile strips, to the east and to the west.
But even so, the abbot wondered, the nomads...
Hannigan's plan for them is devilish. Mad Bear's warriors can easily cope with Laredo's cavalry, but what they can't cope with is a cattle plague. The plains tribes don't know it yet, but when Laredo set out to punish the nomads for border raiding, the Laredans drove several hundred head of diseased cattle ahead to mingle with the nomads' herds. It was Hannigan's idea. The result will be famine, and then it will be easy to set tribe against tribe. We don't, of course, know all the details, but the goal is a nomad legion under a puppet chieftain, armed by Texarkana, loyal to Hannigan, ready to sweep west to the mountains. If it comes to pass, this region will get the first breakers.
But why? Surely Hannigan doesn't expect the barbarians to be dependable troops, or capable of holding an empire once they finish mutilating it.
No, my lord, but the nomad tribes will be disrupted. Denver will be shattered. Then Hannigan can pick up the pieces.
To do what with them? It couldn't be a very rich empire.
No, but secure on all flanks. He might then be in a better position to strike east or northeast. Of course, before it comes to that, his plans may collapse. But whether they collapse or not, this region may well be in danger of being overrun in the not-too-distant future. Steps should be taken to secure the abbey within the next few months. I have instructions to discuss with you the problem of keeping the memorabilia safe. Dom Paolo felt the blackness beginning to gather. After 12 centuries, a little hope had come into the world, and then came an illiterate prince to ride roughshod over it with a barbarian horde, and... His fist exploded onto the desktop.
"We kept them outside our walls for 1,000 years, he growled, "and we can keep them out for another 1,000. This abbey was under siege 3 times during the Bering influx, and once again during the Viserionist schism. We'll keep the books safe. We've kept them that way for quite some time."
"But there is an added hazard these days, my lord."
"What may that be?"
"A bountiful supply of gunpowder and grapeshot." The Feast of the Assumption had come and gone, but still there was no word of the party from Texarkana. Private votive masses for pilgrims and travelers were beginning to be offered by the abbey's priests. Dom Paolo had ceased taking even a light breakfast, and it was whispered that he was doing penance for having invited the scholar at all, in view of the present danger on the plains. The watchtowers remained constantly manned. The abbot himself frequently climbed the wall to peer eastward. Shortly before Vespers, on the Feast of St. Bernard, a novice reported seeing a thin and distant dust trail,
but darkness was coming on, and no one else had been able to make it out. Soon, Compline and the Salve Regina were sung, but still no one appeared at the gates.
"It might have been their advanced scout," suggested Prior Galt.
"It might have been Brother Watchman's imagination," countered Dom Paolo.
"But if they've camped just 10 miles or so down the way, we'd see their fire from the tower. It's a clear night."
"Still, Domne, after the moon rises, we could send a rider."
"Oh, no. That's a good way to get shot by mistake. If it's really them, they've probably kept their fingers on their triggers for the whole trip, especially at night. It can wait until dawn."
It was late the following morning when the expected party of horsemen appeared out of the east. From the top of the wall, Dom Paolo blinked and squinted across the hot and dry terrain, trying to focus myopic eyes on the distance. Dust from the horses' hooves was drifting away to the north. The party had stopped for a parley.
"I seem to be seeing 20 or 30 of them," the abbot complained, rubbing his eyes in annoyance. "Are there really so many?"
"Approximately," said Galt.
"How will we ever take care of them all?"
"I don't think we'll be taking care of the ones with the wolfskins, my lord abbot," the younger priest said stiffly.
"Wolfskins?"
"Nomads, my lord."
"Man the walls, close the gates, let down the shield, break out the—"
"Wait, they're not all nomads, Domne."
"Oh?"
Dom Paolo turned to peer again. The parley was being ended. Men waved, the group split in two. The larger party galloped back toward the east. The remaining horsemen watched briefly, then reined around and trotted toward the abbey.
6 or 7 of them, some in uniform," the abbot murmured as they drew closer.
"The Thon and his party, I'm sure."
"But with nomads? It's a good thing I didn't let you send a rider out last night. What were they doing with nomads?"
"It appeared that they came as guides," Father Galt said darkly. "How neighborly of the lion to lie down with the lamb."
The riders approached the gates. Dom Paolo swallowed dryness.
"Well, we'd better go welcome them, Father," he sighed.
By the time the priests had descended from the wall, the travelers had reined up just outside the courtyard. A horseman detached himself from the others, trotted forward, dismounted, and presented his papers.
"Dom Paolo of Pecos, Abbas?"
The abbot bowed.
"Tibi Atsum, welcome in the name of St. Libowitz, Don Taddeo. Welcome in the name of his abbey, in the name of 40 generations who've waited for you to come. Be at home, we serve you."
The words were heartfelt. The words had been saved for many years, while awaiting this moment. Hearing a muttered monosyllable in reply, Dom Paolo looked up slowly. For a moment his glance locked with the scholars. He felt the warmth quickly fade, those icy eyes, cold and searching gray, skeptical, hungry, and proud. They studied him as one might study a lifeless curio. That this moment might be as a bridge across a gulf of 12 centuries, Paolo had fervently prayed. Prayed, too, that through him the last martyred scientist of that earlier age would clasp hands with tomorrow. There was indeed a gulf, that much was plain. The abbot felt suddenly that he belonged not to this age at all, that he had been left stranded somewhere on a sandbar in Time's river, and that there wasn't really ever a bridge at all.
"Come," he said gently. "Brother Visclair will attend to your horses."
When he had seen the guests installed in their lodgings, and had retired to the privacy of his study, the smile on the face of the wooden saint reminded him unaccountably of the smirk of old Benjamin Eleazar, saying, "The children of this world are consistent, too." Chapter 18
"Now, even as in the time of Job," Brother Reader began from the refectory lectern, "when the sons of God came to stand before the Lord, Satan also was present among them. And the Lord said to him, 'Whence comest thou, Satan?' And Satan, answering, said, as of old, 'I have gone round about the earth and have walked through it.' And the Lord said to him, 'Hast thou considered that simple and upright prince, my servant, Name, hating evil and loving peace?' And Satan, answering, said, 'Doth Name fear God in vain? For hast thou not blessed his hand with great wealth, and made him mighty among nations?
but stretch forth thy hand a little, and decrease what he hath, and let his enemy be strengthened. Then see if he blasphemeth thee not to thy face. And the Lord said to Satan, Behold what he hath, and lessen it. See thou to it. And Satan went forth from the presence of God, and returned into the world. Now the prince's name was not as holy Job, for when his land was afflicted with trouble, and his people less rich than before, when he saw his enemy become mightier, he grew fearful and ceased to trust in God, thinking unto himself, I must strike before the enemy overwhelmeth me without taking his sword in hand. And so it was in those days, said Brother Reader, that the princes of earth had hardened their hearts against the law of the Lord, and of their pride there was no end. And each of them thought within himself that it was better for all to be destroyed than for the will of other princes to prevail over his. For the mighty of the earth did contend among themselves for supreme power over all. By stealth, treachery, and deceit they did seek to rule. And of war they feared greatly and did tremble, for the Lord God had suffered the wise men of those times to learn the means by which the world itself might be destroyed, and into their hands was given the sword of the archangel, wherewith Lucifer had been cast down, that men and princes might fear God and humble themselves before the Most High. But they were not humbled. And Satan spoke unto a certain prince, saying, Fear not to use the sword, for the wise men have deceived you in saying that the world would be destroyed thereby. Listen not to the counsel of weaklings, for they fear you exceedingly, and they serve your enemies by staying your hand against them. Strike, and know that you shall be king over all. And the prince did heed the word of Satan, and he summoned all of the wise men of that realm, and called upon them to give him counsel as to the ways in which the enemy might be destroyed, without bringing down the wrath upon his own kingdom. But most of the wise men said, Lord, it is not possible, for your enemies also have the sword which we have given you, and the fieriness of it is as the flame of hell, and as the fury of the sun's star from whence it was kindled. Then thou shalt make me yet another, which is yet seven times hotter than hell itself, commanded the prince, whose arrogance had come to surpass that of Pharaoh. And many of them said, Nay, Lord, ask not this thing of us, for even the smoke of such a fire, if we were to kindle it for thee, would cause many to perish. Now the prince was angry because of their answer, and he suspected them of betraying him, and he sent his spies among them to tempt them and to challenge them, whereupon the wise men became afraid. Some among them changed their answers, that his wrath be not invoked against them. Three times he asked them, and three times they answered, Nay, Lord, even your own people will perish if you do this thing. But one of the magi, who was like unto Judas Iscariot, and his testimony was crafty, and having betrayed his brothers, he lied to all the people, advising them not to fear the demon fallout. The prince heeded this false wise man, whose name was Blackeneth, and he caused spies to accuse many of the magi before the people. Being afraid, the less wise among the magi counseled the prince according to his pleasure, saying, The weapons may be used, only do not exceed such and such a limit, or all will surely perish. And the prince smote the cities of his enemies with the new fire, and for three more days and nights did his great catapults and metal birds rain wrath upon them. Over each city a sun appeared, and was brighter than the sun of heaven, and immediately that city withered and melted as wax under the torch. And the people thereof did stop in the streets, and their skins smoked, and they became as faggots thrown on the coals. And when the fury of the sun had faded, the city was in flames, and a great thunder came out of the sky, like the great battering ram Picadon, to crush it utterly. Poisonous fumes fell over all the land, and the land was aglow by night with the afterfire and the curse of the afterfire, which caused a scurf on the skin, and made the hair to fall, and the blood to die in the veins. And a great stink went up from the earth, even unto heaven. Like unto Sodom and Gomorrah was the earth and the ruins thereof, even in the land of that certain prince, for his enemies did not withhold their vengeance, sending fire in turn to engulf his cities as their own. The stink of the carnage was exceedingly offensive to the Lord, who spoke unto the prince, saying, What burnt offering is this that you have prepared before me? What is this saber that arises from the place of holocaust? Have you made me a holocaust of sheep or goats, or offered a calf unto God? But the prince answered him not, and God said, You have made me a holocaust of my sons. And the Lord slew him together with Blackeneth, the betrayer. And there was pestilence in the earth, and madness was upon mankind, who stoned the wise together with the powerful, those who remained. But there was in that time a man whose name was Leibowitz, who, in his youth, like the holy Augustine, had loved the wisdom of the world more than the wisdom of God. But now, seeing that great knowledge, while good, had not saved the world, he turned in penance to the Lord, crying, The abbot rapped sharply on the table, and the monk who had been reading the ancient account was immediately silent.
"And that is your only account of it?"
asked Don Taddeo, smiling tightly at the abbot across the study.
"Oh, there are several versions. They differ in minor details. No one is certain which nation launched the first attack. Not that it matters any more. The text Brother Reader was just reading was written a few decades after the death of St. Leibowitz. Probably one of the first accounts, after it became safe to write again. The author was a young monk who had not lived through the destruction himself. He got it second-hand from St. Leibowitz's followers, the original memorizers and bookleggers, and he had a liking for scriptural mimicry. I doubt if a single, completely accurate account of the flame deluge exists anywhere. Once it started, it was apparently too immense for any one person to see the whole picture.
In what land was this prince called Name and this man Blackeneth?
Abbot Paolo shook his head.
Not even the author of that account was certain. We've pieced enough together since that was written to know that even some of the lesser rulers of that time had got their hands on such weapons before the Holocaust came. The situation he described prevailed in more than one nation. Name and Blackeneth were probably legion.
Of course, I've heard similar legends. It's obvious that something rather hideous came to pass, the Thon stated, and then abruptly, But when may I begin to examine, what do you call it?
The memorabilia.
Of course.
He sighed and smiled absently at the image of the saint in the corner.
Would tomorrow be too soon?
You may begin at once, if you like, said the abbot. Feel free to come and go as you please.
The vaults were dimly filled with candlelight, and only a few dark-robed scholar monks moved about in the stalls. Brother Armbruster pored gloomily over his records in a puddle of lamplight in his cubbyhole at the foot of the stone stairway, and one lamp burned in the moral theology alcove, where a robed figure huddled over ancient manuscript. It was after prime, when most of the community labored at their duties about the abbey, in kitchen, classroom, garden, stable, and office, leaving the library nearly empty until late afternoon, and time for Lectio Divina. This morning, however, the vaults were comparatively crowded. Three monks stood lounging in the shadows behind the new machine. They kept their hands tucked in their sleeves and watched a fourth monk who stood at the foot of the stairs. The fourth monk gazed patiently up toward a fifth monk who stood on the landing and watched the entrance to the stairway. Brother Kornhoer had brooded over his apparatus like an anxious parent, but when he could no longer find wires to wiggle and adjustments to make and remake, he retired to the natural theology alcove to read and wait. To speak a summary of last-minute instructions to his crew would be permissible, but he chose to maintain the hush, and if any thought of the coming moment as a personal climax crossed his mind as he waited, the monastic inventor's expression gave no hint of it. Since the abbot himself had not bothered to watch a demonstration of the machine, Brother Kornhoer betrayed no symptoms of expecting applause from any quarter, and he had even overcome his tendency to glance reproachfully at Dom Paolo. A low hiss from the stairway alerted the basement again, although there had been several earlier false alarms. Clearly, no one had informed the illustrious Thon that a marvelous invention awaited his inspection in the basement. Clearly, if it had been mentioned to him at all, its importance had been minimized. Obviously, Father Abbot was seeing to it that they all cooled their heels. These were the wordless significances exchanged by glances among them as they waited. This time the warning hiss had not been in vain. The monk who watched from the head of the stairs turned solemnly and bowed toward the fifth monk on the landing below.
"In principio Deus,"
he said softly. The fifth monk turned and bowed toward the fourth monk at the foot of the stairs.
"Caelum et terram creavit,"
he murmured in turn. The fourth monk turned toward the three who lounged behind the machine.
"Vacuus autem erat mundus," he announced.
"Cum tenebris in superficie profundorum," chorused the group. "Ortus est Dei Spiritus supra aquas," called Brother Kornhoer, returning his book to its shelf with a rattling of chains.
"Gratias creatori spiritui," responded his entire team.
"Dixitque Deus, fiat lux,"
said the inventor in a tone of command. The vigil on the stairs descended to take their posts. Four monks manned the treadmill, the fifth monk hovered over the dynamo. The sixth monk climbed the shelf ladder and took his seat on the top rung, his head bumping the top of the archway. He pulled a mask of smoke-blackened, oily parchment over his face to protect his eyes, then felt for the lamp fixture and its thumbscrew, while Brother Kornhoer watched him nervously from below.
"Et lux ergo facta est," he said when he had found the screw.
"Lucem esse bonam Deus vidit,"
the inventor called to the fifth monk. The fifth monk bent over the dynamo with a candle for one last look at the brush contacts.
"Et secrevit lucem a tenebris,"
he said at last, continuing the lesson.
"Lucem appellavit diem,"
chorused the treadmill team,
"et tenebras noctes."
Whereupon they set their shoulders to the turnstile beams. Axles creaked and groaned. The wagon wheel dynamo began to spin, its low whir becoming a moan, and then a whine, as the monks strained and grunted at the drive mill. The guardian of the dynamo watched anxiously as the spokes blurred with speed and became a film.
"Vespere ocaso," he began,
then paused to lick two fingers and touch them to the contacts. A spark snapped.
"Lucifer,"
he yelped, leaping back, then finished lamely,
"Ortus est et primo die."
"Contact," said Brother Kornhoer, as Don Paolo, Thantadio, and his clerk descended the stairs. The monk on the ladder struck the arc. A sharp spfft and blinding light flooded the vaults with a brilliance that had not been seen in 12 centuries. The group stopped on the stairs. Thantadio gasped an oath in his native tongue. He retreated a step. The abbot, who had neither witnessed the testing of the device nor credited extravagant claims, blanched and stopped speech in mid-sentence. The clerk froze momentarily in panic and suddenly fled, screaming,
"Fire!"
The abbot made the sign of the cross.
"I had not known," he whispered.
The scholar, having survived the first shock of the flare, probed the basement with his gaze, noticing the drive mill, the monks who strained at its beams. His eyes traveled along the wrapped wires, noticed the monk on the ladder, measured the meaning of the wagon wheel dynamo and the monk who stood waiting with downcast eyes at the foot of the stairs.
"Incredible," he breathed.
The monk at the foot of the stairs bowed in acknowledgement and appreciation. The blue-white glare cast knife-edged shadows in the room, and the candle flames became blurred wisps in the tide of light.
"Bright as 1,000 torches, breathed the scholar. "It must be an ancient... but no, unthinkable."
He moved on down the stairs like a man in a trance. He stopped beside Brother Kornhoer and gazed at him curiously for a moment, then stepped onto the basement floor. Touching nothing, asking nothing, peering at everything, he wandered about the machinery, inspecting the dynamo, the wiring, the lamp itself.
"It just doesn't seem possible, but..."
The abbot recovered his senses and descended the stairs.
"You're dispensed from silence," he whispered at Brother Kornhoer. "Talk to him. I'm a little dazed."
The monk brightened. "You like it, my lord abbot?"
"Ghastly,"
wheezed Dom Paolo. The inventor's countenance sagged.
"It's a shocking way to treat a guest. It frightened the Than's assistant out of his wits. I'm mortified."
"Well, it is rather bright."
"Hellish. Go talk to him while I think of a way to apologize."
But the scholar had apparently made a judgment on the basis of his observations, for he stalked toward them swiftly. His face seemed strained and his manner crisp.
"A lamp of electricity," he said. "How have you managed to keep it hidden for all these centuries?
after all these years of trying to arrive at a theory of—
He choked slightly and seemed to be fighting for self-control, as if he had been the victim of a monstrous practical joke.
Why have you hidden it? Is there some religious significance? And what—
Complete confusion stopped him. He shook his head and looked around as if for an escape.
You misunderstand,
the abbot said weakly, catching at Brother Kornhauer's arm.
For the love of God, brother, explain.
But there was no balm to soothe an affront to professional pride, then or in any other age. Chapter 19. After the unfortunate incident in the basement, the abbot sought, by every conceivable means, to make amends for that unhappy moment. Fontadio gave no outward sign of rancor, and even offered his hosts an apology for his spontaneous judgment of the incident, after the inventor of the device had given the scholar a detailed account of its recent design and manufacture. But the apology succeeded only in convincing the abbot further that the blunder had been serious. It put the Thon in the position of a mountaineer who has scaled an unconquered height, only to find a rival's initials carved in the summit rock. And the rival hadn't told him in advance. It must have been shattering for him, Dom Paolo thought, because of the way it was handled. If the Thon had not insisted, with a firmness perhaps born of embarrassment, that its light was of a superior quality, sufficiently bright even for close scrutiny of brittle and age-worn documents, which tended to be indecipherable by candlelight, Dom Paolo would have removed the lamp from the basement immediately. But Thon Taddeo had insisted that he liked it, only to discover then that it was necessary to keep at least 4 novices or postulants continuously employed at cranking the dynamo and adjusting the arc gap. Thereupon, he begged that the lamp be removed, but then it was Paolo's turn to become insistent that it remain in place. So it was that the scholar began his researches at the abbey, continuously aware of the 3 novices who toiled at the drive mill, and the 4th novice who invited glare blindness atop the ladder to keep the lamp burning and adjusted, a situation which caused the poet to versify mercilessly concerning the demon embarrassment and the outrages he perpetrated in the name of penitence or appeasement. For several days the Thon and his assistant studied the library itself, the files, the monastery's records apart from the memorabilia, as if by determining the validity of the oyster they might establish the possibility of the pearl. Brother Kornhauer discovered the Thon's assistant on his knees in the entrance of the refectory, and for a moment he entertained the impression that the fellow was performing some special devotion before the image of Mary above the door. But a rattle of tools put an end to the illusion. The assistant laid a carpenter's level across the entranceway and measured the concave depression worn in the floor stones by centuries of monastic sandals.
"We're looking for ways of determining dates," he told Kornhauer when questioned. "This seemed like a good place to establish a standard for rate of wear, since the traffic's easy to estimate. 3 meals per man per day since the stones were laid."
Kornhauer could not help being impressed by their thoroughness. The activity mystified him.
"The abbey's architectural records are complete," he said. "They can tell you exactly when each building and wing was added. Why not save your time?"
The man glanced up innocently.
"My master has a saying, Nayal is without speech, and therefore never lies."
"Nayal?"
"One of the nature gods of the Red River people. He means it figuratively, of course. Objective evidence is the ultimate authority. Recorders may lie, but nature is incapable of it."
He noticed the monk's expression, and added hastily,
"No canard is implied. It is simply a doctrine of the Thons that everything must be cross-referenced to the objective."
"A fascinating notion,"
murmured Kornhauer, and bent down to examine the man's sketch of a cross-section of the floor's concavity.
"Why, it's shaped like what Brother Majek calls a normal distribution curve. How strange."
"Not strange. The probability of a footstep deviating from the center line would tend to follow the normal error function."
Kornhauer was enthralled.
"I'll call Brother Majek," he said.
The abbot's interest in his guest's inspection of the premises was less esoteric.
"Why," he demanded of Galt, "are they making detailed drawings of our fortifications?"
The prior looked surprised.
"I hadn't heard of it. You mean Thon Taddeo?"
"No. The officers that came with him, they're going about it quite systematically."
"How did you find out?"
"The poet told me."
the poet, ha! Unfortunately, he was telling the truth this time. He pickpocketed one of their sketches.
You have it?
No, I made him return it, but I don't like it. It's ominous.
I suppose the poet asked a price for the information.
Oddly enough, he didn't. He took an instant dislike to the Thon. He's gone around muttering to himself ever since they came.
The poet has always muttered,
but not in a serious vein.
Why do you suppose they're making the drawings?
Paolo made a grim mouth. Unless we find out otherwise, we'll assume their interest is recondite and professional. As a walled citadel, the abbey has been a success. It's never been taken by siege or assault, and perhaps their professional admiration is aroused.
Father Gault gazed speculatively across the desert toward the east.
Come to think of it, if an army meant to strike west across the plains, they'd probably have to establish a garrison somewhere in this region before marching on Denver.
He thought for a few moments and began to look alarmed.
And here they'd have a fortress ready-made. I'm afraid that's occurred to them.
You think they were sent as spies?
No, no. I doubt if Hannigan himself has ever heard of us. But they are here, and they are officers, and they can't help looking around and getting ideas. And now, very likely, Hannigan is going to hear about us.
What do you intend doing?
I don't know yet.
Why not talk to Thon Taddeo about it?
The officers aren't his servants. They were only sent as an escort to protect him. What can he do?
He's Hannigan's kinsman, and he has influence.
The abbot nodded. I'll try to think of a way to approach him on the matter. We'll watch what's going on for a while first, though.
In the days that followed, Thon Taddeo completed his study of the oyster and, apparently satisfied that it was not a disguised clam, focused his attention on the pearl. The task was not simple. Quantities of facsimile copy were scrutinized. Chains rattled and clanked as the more precious books came down from their shelves. In the case of partially damaged or deteriorated originals, it seemed unwise to trust the facsimile maker's interpretation and eyesight. The actual manuscripts, dating back to Leibowitzian times, which had been sealed in airtight casks and locked in special storage vaults for indefinitely long preservation, were then brought out. The Thon's assistant assembled several pounds of notes. After the fifth day of it, Thon Taddeo's pace quickened, and his manner reflected the eagerness of a hungry hound, catching scent of tasty game.
Magnificent!
He vacillated between jubilation and amused incredulity.
Fragments from a 20th-century physicist. The equations are even consistent.
Cornhoer peered over his shoulder.
I've seen that, he said breathlessly. I could never make heads or tails of it. Is the subject matter important?
I'm not sure yet. The mathematics is beautiful, beautiful. Look here, this expression. Notice the extremely contracted form. This thing under the radical sign, it looks like the product of two derivatives, but it really represents a whole set of derivatives.
How?
The indices permute into an expanded expression. Otherwise, it couldn't possibly represent a line integral as the author says it is. It's lovely. And see here, this simple-looking expression. The simplicity is deceptive. It obviously represents not one, but a whole system of equations in a very contracted form. It took me a couple of days to realize that the author was thinking of the relationships, not just of quantities to quantities, but of whole systems to other systems. I don't yet know all the physical quantities involved, but the sophistication of the mathematics is just quietly superb. If it's a hoax, it's inspired. If it's authentic, we may be in unbelievable luck. In either case, it's magnificent. I must see the earliest possible copy of it.
Brother Librarian groaned as yet another lead-sealed cask was rolled out of storage for unsealing. Armbruster was not impressed by the fact that the secular scholar, in 2 days, had unraveled a bit of a puzzle that had been lying around, a complete enigma for a dozen centuries. To the custodian of the memorabilia, each unsealing represented another decrease in the probable lifetime of the contents of the cask, and he made no attempt to conceal his disapproval of the entire proceeding. To Brother Librarian, whose task in life was the preservation of books, the principal reason for the existence of books was that they might be preserved perpetually. Usage was secondary, and to be avoided if it threatened longevity. Thon Taddeo's enthusiasm for his task waxed stronger as the days passed, and the abbot breathed easier as he watched the Than's earlier skepticism melt away with each new perusal of some fragmentary pre-deluge science text. The scholar had not made any clear assertions about the intended scope of his investigation. Perhaps, at first, his aim had been vague, but now he went about his work with the crisp precision of a man following a plan. Sensing the dawn of something, Don Paolo decided to offer the cock a perch for crowing, in case the bird felt an impulse to announce a coming daybreak. "The community has been curious about your labors," he told the scholar. "We'd like to hear about it, if you don't mind discussing it. Of course, we've all heard of your theoretical work at your own collegium, but it's too technical for most of us to understand. Would it be possible for you to tell us something about it in, general terms that non-specialists might understand? The community has been grumping at me because I hadn't invited you to lecture, but I thought you might prefer to get the feel of the place first. Of course, if you'd rather not." The Than's gaze seemed to clamp calipers on the abbot's cranium and measure it six ways. He smiled doubtfully. "You'd like me to explain our work in the simplest possible language?" "Something like that, if it's possible." "That's just it," he laughed. "The untrained man reads a paper on natural science and thinks, 'Now, why couldn't he explain this in simple language?' He can't seem to realize that what he tried to read was the simplest possible language for that subject matter. In fact, a great deal of natural philosophy is simply a process of linguistic simplification, an effort to invent languages in which half a page of equations can express an idea which could not be stated in less than 1,000 pages of so-called simple language. Do I make myself clear?"
"I think so. Since you do make yourself clear, perhaps you could tell us about that aspect of it, then, unless the suggestion is premature, as far as your work with the memorabilia is concerned?"
"Well, no. We now have a fairly clear idea of where we're going, and what we have to work with here. It will still take us. The pieces have to be fitted together, and they don't all belong to the same puzzle. We can't yet predict what we can glean from it, but we're fairly sure of what we can't. I'm happy to say it looks hopeful. I have no objection to explaining the general scope, but..." He repeated the doubtful shrug.
"What bothers you?"
The Than seemed mildly embarrassed. "Only an uncertainty about my audience. I would not wish to offend anyone's religious beliefs."
"But how could you? Isn't it a matter of natural philosophy? Of physical science?"
"Of course, but many people's ideas about the world have become colored with religious... Well, what I mean is..."
"But if your subject matter is the physical world, how could you possibly offend, especially this community? We've been waiting for a long time to see the world start taking an interest in itself again. At the risk of seeming boastful, I might point out that we have a few rather clever amateurs in natural science right here in the monastery. There's Brother Majek, and there's Brother Kornhauer."
"Kornhauer?" The Than glanced up warily at the arc lamp and looked away, blinking. "I can't understand it."
"The lamp? But surely you..."
"No, no, not the lamp. The lamp's simple enough, once you get over the shock of seeing it really work. It should work. It would work on paper, assuming various undeterminables and guessing at some unavailable data. But the clean, impetuous leap from the vague hypothesis to a working model..." The Than coughed nervously. "It's Kornhauer himself I don't understand. That gadget," he waggled a forefinger at the dynamo, "is a standing broad jump across about 20 years of preliminary experimentation, starting with an understanding of the principles. Kornhauer just dispensed with the preliminaries. You believe in miraculous interventions?"
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse.